Blog Talk Radio.
Hey there! Welcome to Big Blend Radio with your hosts, Lisa and Nancy, editors of BigBlendMagazine.com.
Well, Mara Pearl, who's the author of the best-selling Milford Haven novels, is our first guest on today's Happy Hour show right here on Big Blend Radio, and she's a recipient of 28 book awards. Oh. The Milford Haven Saga is the only series with a serial mystery. See, that's pretty cool. Like, mm-hmm. It's like this keeps going on, and you finish the end of the book, and you're like, now what?
Yeah.
The saga is based on her BBC radio drama, which had over 4.5 million UK listeners.
Wow.
It's a lot. And as an actress, Mara played the role of Darla Cook in Days of Our Lives and was a journalist for the AP, the Rolling Stone, and the Financial Times of London. Now, you can keep up with Mara. Go to marapearl.com, and that's M-A-R-A, and then P-U-R-L.com. So marapearl.com. Of course, get her books on Amazon, all those good online stores. She's also on Facebook and Twitter. Mara, it's good to have you back on the show. How are you?
Very well. Thank you so much, Nancy and Lisa. My goodness, you're awesome. All your travel, all your national parks, it's fantastic.
You know, the last time we talked to you, I think it was February 2014, when we were up in Yosemite on our way. We left mm-hmm. from there and we went to Marin County, where we experienced small towns on the ocean, too, just kind of similar to where you are in the Central Coast, right?
Yes. Beautiful area.
And now Milford Haven, we talked about that on that interview, about it being like a small coastal town, and everybody gets to know each other, and there's this, you know, the community, but you have drama in your community, in your
yes,
novel.
Yes, perhaps a little too much drama, but, there's a real
always.
Town called Cambria, which is halfway between San Francisco and Los Angeles, and it's quite near San Simeon, which is where the Hearst Castle is. And there's just enough room between those two that if my fictional town were real, that's where it would be.
And that area is beautiful. That's where we saw whales.
Mm-hmm.
That's whale watching.
Oh, yes.
That one time
yes.
So.
Mm-hmm.
So now I heard that you are actually in a play right now. Tell us a little bit about that.
Oh, it's a beautiful play called Sea Marks by Gardner McKay. And oddly enough, 30 years ago, this was what brought me to Cambria and the Central Coast for the first time. I was a young actress. I loved this and was invited. It's just a two-character piece. He's an Irish fisherman. She's in the publishing business in Liverpool, but she's from Wales. And it's romantic and funny and sad and poetic and just haunting. So we had a great run during the entire summer, and it kind of bounced us into the next category of our careers, both my co-star and I. So for
now,
me, go ahead.
No, I was reading that. I thought, weren't you in Colorado Springs doing this too earlier in February for your dad's 100th birthday to honor your dad?
We were. Yes, yes. So we hadn't done the play in all these years. We realized it had been 30 years, and these two opportunities came up, one to do it in Colorado and the other to do it back in Cambria in the original theater where we had first done it. So we had a great run in February, and my dad, who had directed us 30 years ago in the Colorado, he was a graduate of Yale Drama School and grew up in the theater, so I'm third generation in the theater, actually. And so we were doing a special run to honor him, and he just missed turning 100, but he was just very excited about our show, and it was a great experience.
So now this has continued forth, and so you've been doing this all year pretty much now.
Well, we had the February-March run, and then in Cambria we opened 2 weeks ago, and it is going so well. We're just, the houses are full, and we've gotten nice reviews, and we're just so enjoying this material. And then by day, it gives me a chance to continue to do my research for my next story, which, as you mentioned, is about otters. We have a lot of otters right there in Cambria.
You know, I remember going on the Central Coast and seeing otters and Nancy and I did get to see them, and you know, all the way up, like into Monterey and that area. And you know, otters, you know, here in Yuma, Arizona, where we're based right now on our tour, we have the Lower Colorado River, and we walk on the river every morning that we can early. And we got lucky last year to see some of the beavers, and so they're kind of connected in some way. I just kind of call the otters the ocean beavers. But there's something so amazing, and, you know, we get so excited about the beavers. You see their tail marks and everything. But, you know, we'll talk to some people, and the first thing they want to do, and we lost a lot of beavers because of hunting over the years in the Southwest.
We'll see
and
trapping.
Hunting and trapping. And beaver's fur was used on all the top hats back in the day. What is it like for otters? Are they battling? Because I know that even off of the Central Coastline, there was an oil spill. Are you finding issues in regards to them having to kind of come back in some way? Are they having any issues?
You've put your finger right on it, Lisa. That's exactly what's been going on. It's interesting. The otters are much more political than I realized before I started doing research. And I've actually been working with the director of the otter program at the Monterey Aquarium to really, you know, fact check and figure out some of the behaviors. Otters they don't have any blubber, so the only way they can stay warm is with their pelts, which have more hair per square inch than any other creature. And it's this divinely silky, fantastic fur. So they, too, were hunted almost to extinction. And a little colony of otters was found along the Central Coast near Big Sur and slowly began to build back because they were now being protected from hunters. They have natural predators as well, so they were being hit from all sides. But now they are coming back, and the species I'm focusing on is this called the Southern California otters. But it's still kind of political because in that part of the world, there's an area called Point Conception. It has very dramatic ocean currents, so it's a rather treacherous place for ships and boats. Well, there's a military installation, and, you know, they think that area is theirs. They're the oil business with lots of offshore rigs, and they think the area is theirs. There are the environmentalists who are trying to protect the otters and other species, and they think the area is theirs. And then you have the Chumash, who know the area is theirs because it was in the first place. So it's all very political. And you have commercial fishermen trying to still get urchins and abalones, which are the favorite foods of the otters, and they're competing for that food source. So the story that I'm writing has a lot of different aspects to it.
You know, so what, you know, because this is the third one. You've done one on whales and hummingbirds. You know, so what was it that, and, you know, going back to that, it's interesting because it's still the Milford Haven story, right? So you're still set in Milford Haven with this. And they've got When Whales Watch and When Hummers Dream. What was it for you that decided to go more in the nature thing instead of, well, it's still a mystery, right? It's still, in a way, a mystery because you don't know what happens to these animals, and there's stuff going on. There's drama that's happening because of humans.
Yeah. Well, the novels concern, you know, a pretty big cast of characters. And these little short stories focus on my protagonist, Miranda, who is a painter of wildlife. And so she gets interested in a particular species. And so for the whale story, you know, she went on a whale-watching trip expecting to see the migrating gray whales. To her surprise, she also saw a sperm whale, and sperm whales don't usually come that close into coastal waters. So that was a dramatic adventure story, and she found herself in the middle of a potential crisis. And that was a really fun, interesting story to write. And the otters is her next painting that she'll be doing. And, you know, they're interesting because they don't go into the deep ocean like the sperm whales. They are really coastal creatures. They're the only critters in the ocean who have hands. And they live their lives really pretty much within sight of humans. So we see them and they see us. and they interact with us. They're little Dickens. They love to play, and they're curious, and they get into all kinds of things. So I think, you know, all I knew when I started to work on the story was how cute they are. And now I've discovered also how smart they are and how difficult their lives are, and they're just fascinating.
Yeah, you know, because even, you know, going on the river and Nancy and I being, you know, the ocean areas too, we see fishing line lift. You see things get stuck on birds, and you see things, you know, you're like,
bad.
And you want to help, and there's like, sometimes you can help an animal and get them to a rescue to be able to pull wire out of them and fish hooks and things like that, but it's hard when it's the ocean, and they're out there, and otters are cool. I mean, they hold their hands together to sleep.
Yeah, they're just so cute.
You know, to keep them float.
They're so cute.
And, you know, I've seen that where they just, there's that buoyancy, but so they don't drift apart, they hold on to each other. Like, it looks like they're, you know, walking down the aisle, but they're on their backs holding each other. You know, it's cool.
Yeah,
but,
and they wrap themselves in kelp when they go to sleep so that they don't drift away.
That's smart, huh?
That is, I mean,
it really.
Yeah.
Nancy, you always say this, everything that we invent in life comes from nature.
Absolutely. You know, I can't think of one thing that didn't start with somebody looking at something nature does and copying it.
Right.
You know, I mean, it's just amazing how everything locks into place and how it works. And otters are so, they're ambidextrous and they are cute, but they're also, you know, they're still little wild animals, so you you know, you don't want to go and try and pet one, that's for sure. But
No.
Yeah, well,
you wouldn't want to. I mean, they'll defend themselves, and
yeah, they will.
There's a wonderful ecosystem that really works well. So the otters need the kelp, and one of their favorite foods is the urchin, and urchins like to munch on the root of the kelp, which would, left alone, that would destroy the kelp forest.
Right.
So it's this sort of beautiful symbiotic system where they all protect each other.
Right. And it balances out until we come along. There was a restaurant at the end of the pier in Redondo Beach where you were kind of looking out into the water and you could see otters once in a while if you were really, 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 really lucky.
Was that
and
Santa Barbara?
No, Redondo Beach has one, and I'm sure Santa Barbara also has. But, there, you know, if you see an otter, and especially up close, you're really fortunate.
Yeah. I want to see one again. It's been a while, you know, and they just they're so cute. But I wonder, like, how is it in regards to what the fishing in California? Do you have a lot of that as an issue?
It is an issue. The commercial fishermen, as I was mentioning, are competing with the otters to get these more exotic foods. I think that urchin, most of them, are not even sold in California sushi places. They're sold to Japan because Japan has, I think, fished out all the urchins that they had. So, you know, it looks like a spiny, very difficult creature to get at, but the otters have no difficulty with that.
Yeah, and those spines are poisonous.
Yeah,
too.
I mean, when we lived in Kenya, I remember snorkeling as a little kid and having to wear, you know, tennis shoes, so that if you do like put your feet down, you're not even wearing flippers at that point because there's so many urchins out there. But I don't know about now, because this was when I was a kid. But you know, it you had to watch it. I had a friend that she got an urchin stuck in her knee. And she had issues. I mean, they had to pull every one of those pointers out of her knee. It was like a porcupine. Mm-hmm. They're like the porcupines of the sea.
Yeah, porcupines.
You know,
yeah.
But that's how that ecosystem works between nature under the ocean. You know, it's like, okay, urchins and, you know, otters, they can handle it. We shouldn't be messing with it. I mean, I understand people need to eat fish and everything, but there's at least a good movement of people wanting to eat the fish that are now overabundant in our ocean because of what's happening with climate change and then exotic species being put in people's homes and then hurricanes happen and then they end up in the ocean and stuff like that. So they're breeding
the
lionfish. People are trying to eat those and things like that instead. So at least maybe that will be a better way to go. I don't know, but it's sad to see, especially on the coastline, because you guys had that oil spill out there too. And it takes a long time to clean up from
mm-hmm.
oil spills.
Yeah,
it takes
long time. Yeah, it's devastating to a lot of species, certainly damaging to urchins, to octopus. Without blubber, their only way of staying warm is their fur, which is why you constantly see them grooming themselves.
Mm.
So if they get oil on that fur, they freeze to death.
Wow.
That sucks.
It does.
Like, that really sucks.
So it's really interesting to...
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting to write a story that can highlight these issues and show
mm-hmm.
the human interaction and the different motives, and hopefully
mm-hmm.
help people make the best possible choices.
It's always interesting to me the way the oil companies insist that, oh, we're going to do this, and there's absolutely no danger, no, we're not going to have a spill, and no, this can't happen, and we have all the security and safety precautions, and bada boom, bada bing, there goes another spill.
Right.
You know? And then it's like, oops. Yeah, and it does incredible damage for years and years and years. And, yes, efforts are made to clean up, but it does so much damage. And I don't know that an area really totally ever really recovers.
Mm-mm. It doesn't.
At least in our lifetimes.
At least over 100 years to truly
mm-hmm.
clean it. You know, Mara, I wanted to ask in regards to you putting this as part of one of your Milford Haven, you know, stories. It's a novella part of it. You know, are you getting
mm-hmm.
the community involved in it, in your story?
Yes. The Central Coast, I have a lot of readers in that area. I speak every year at various events there, large and small. And I feel like I'm on a journey together with the people in that area. And that's one of the reasons I spend so much time doing my research.
Mm-hmm.
I really want to portray these things accurately. Plus, it becomes a lens. I think of stories as a lens through which you can look even more deeply at the
mm-hmm.
issues of life. You know, I think that nonfiction is for facts, but fiction is about truth. And you can really go deeper.
It really brings the emotion.
Yeah, because you can't learn all
yeah.
the data. Learning data is really difficult unless you're geeking out on it for a specific reason. Or you're already,
mm-hmm, right.
something has prompted you, like fiction or a movie, right? It's got to have that, you've got to hit, it's the emotional cord that has to be hit. You know,
it has to be not only your head, but your heart that gets involved.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Because and then you draw on passion, and then you can start making changes, looking into it, and moving forward of what has to happen. But I do believe, you know, with us doing our tour of the national parks, what we've learned is, like, if a national park or a national park unit, whether it's the smallest park unit, I mean, there's 408, 59 of them being places like Yosemite or Pinnacles National Park and places like that. The rest are these smaller, unique areas, these national monuments or national historic trails or seashores and things like that. But if they're unhealthy for some reason, they're a huge part of the community because, you know, parks keep the nature, they keep the history, they're the vault. And it needs to be pristine. And once they're sick, for some reason, if it's environmental or lack of funding or things like that, or climate change, pollution, all these things affect them, then it means the community is not happy and healthy. So it's interesting because you put your novels, your Milford Haven novels, in the smaller community, and now you're going on this nature side. So I think it's a really good balance where people can understand that, hey, if the otters aren't doing well, what that means, what's going to happen to our community in the end?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yes, I love that. It is interwoven. And the national parks are, I love what you said, that they are the vaults. I so agree with that. My husband and I have our national parks passport, and we've been to quite a few, and we really do try to visit, you know, a few each year.
Cool.
We always learn so much, and I feel I'd love for more people to commit to seeing as many of the parks as possible.
Well, the parks do bring in a lot of money to the communities that surround them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting, as we travel, as we deal with the parks and then we deal with the community, and sometimes it's kind of amazing to us to find a community that doesn't actually even know part of their history or their park or how much money the park brings in. They're kind of disconnected. So, one of the things we really try to do is bring the two together so the community understands the value of the park. And then the park can work with the community to, when the government wants to shut down and who cares who it hurts, those are the small communities that really, really hurt. So they can say something to their representatives and say, whoa, wait a minute, I now know, I now understand, I lose revenue when you don't do your job, so could you please get your little butt back to work?
And I'm trying to do the same thing with my stories, too. And Lisa, you were mentioning, just really tying together. We sometimes feel or pretend that we are operating kind of solo, but we're not. We're connected, to the flora, the fauna around us. And the more we know, the more we can just be in so grateful and just be in awe of this intelligent system that we're living in.
That's a really good point. I'm going to get myself in trouble, but I don't really care what people, I care, but it's, in other words, believe in what you want to believe in religion-wise, right? But when it comes to looking at what nature is, it's profound. You can't ignore the fact of when you go into nature, there's some kind of creativity. There's this amazing higher force of something that created this. And I'm not saying anything. I'm not going down that road. But there is this humbling thing that happens to you where you realize, this little fern has its leaf this way, so this tree frog can go on there. And that means that this moth can actually do its eggs underneath that one frond. There's all these little intricate things in nature when you slow down and walk through it and just sit down. Just sit down in nature, have that quiet calm, and you just watch. You will start to really realize how big life is and how big the universe is and understand how small we really are. And like as a community, until we get to that level as communities, whether it's a small community like Milford Haven, Yuma, Arizona, where we're based right now, it is the entire country or the world, we're still small. And if you want to impact something, we really do have to connect together.
I totally agree with what you're saying. And something I've been learning about is called index species.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes we think something is small, but that doesn't mean it's insignificant.
Absolutely.
So an index species, I found out the otter is one, for example. And that means that there's a little system that revolves around them. So if you were to take them out of the equation, that whole little system would collapse. So that's what I was saying about they eat the urchins, and since the urchins like the kelp, that means that the urchins are right there where the otters are, conveniently.
Mm-hmm.
But it also means that the otters are protecting their own kelp forest, which is their habitat.
Mm.
And it's just, talk about intelligence.
It's cool.
The food source, the safety, and then the kelp then support. While the otters are supporting the kelp supports them and many other species, including us. It's very cool.
How does that include us? How does that include us? Go on
that
a little bit.
Because it's protecting the coastal regions.
Mm-hmm.
There's a certain amount of environmental cleanup that happens as a result of the kelp. Certain plants will ingest toxins and turn them into harmless plant sugars. There's a similar system, for example, in Florida with the manatee.
Mm-hmm.
The manatees like water lilies, and water lilies ingest toxins and turn them into plant sugar. But water lilies also clog the waterways unless the manatees are there to eat them. So
that
protects the boating.
Yeah.
It's a brilliant
what
system.
With the hippo. Yeah. Happens with the hippo. In Africa, if they keep killing hippos, they're going to have clogs and they're not going to be able to go anywhere water-wise.
Mm-hmm.
So these species have all of them, index or not, whatever, how you want to say that, all of them have a place. And I think
yes.
we're the only ones who get, we're the ones causing the problems.
And bringing the invasive species in, too.
Yeah, like you mentioned earlier, you know, okay, Japan overfished their water, so now they're going to come out here and fish. And, you know, and I'm like, go back home.
Dude, no.
don't come messing
yeah,
over
well,
here.
So
messing up.
We need to figure out, because we probably are a major index species ourselves.
Oh, yeah.
So if we can be smart about it and learn enough from nature, then we can find the right place for us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Instead
it
of
should
being
be nature
too
and
predatory.
Nurture. Nature and
yes.
nurture should be our two, like, N-words, the good N-words.
Yep.
Nature and nurture,
yes,
you
I
know?
Agree.
Now, from doing what you're doing in regard to writing about wildlife, I know sea life, too, which is really important because when we look at climate change, we're seeing what's happening in sea. Like you're talking about the whales, and hummingbirds are a whole other interesting thing. So I'm not even go there yet. But from you looking at nature and studying it, I know you go between Colorado and then, you know, California, and, you know, you see two different drastic areas, two completely different places. How does nature and wildlife, when you look at that and research it, study it, influence your characters in your Milford Haven novels?
Well, I think we could look at all the characters and get a lot of information about them just by seeing where they stand about nature, environmental issues, and wildlife. Now, my protagonist, of course, loves wildlife, makes her living by creating beautiful paintings and studying them. She has a manager who really doesn't care about all that as long as Miranda's paintings sell. I mean, she's very crass about it. She talked at one point, she'd just as soon, you know, make a fur coat out of some of the critters that Miranda
Ew.
Is painting. And that tells you something about Zelda. Her focus is money. And I'm not saying that she's all bad, but that's a big clue as to her motives. And her life in... as we'll see as the story continues, her life is really poorer than it could be because she's focused on something so materialistic. So
oh, yeah.
some of the things
mm-hmm.
that happen to her will come along to give her an opportunity to correct that or change that. And
mm-hmm.
whether she chooses to, we don't know yet. But meanwhile, we have a character we love to hate.
Mm-hmm.
And,
yeah,
and
you know
there
but that
are other
helps
creatures.
You also push you towards good actions as a human being. You have to have that little, you have to have that thorn. Just and they say on your side, but I think it's got to be under your butt. It's just like, ooh, you know, you're like, dude, this, you're making me mad. And then it's like, if you don't get mad, the only way to solve being mad is to go out and do something about it, in a positive way. Just got to add that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I give my characters opportunities. There are always opportunities for growth and insight and wisdom. And there
mm-hmm.
are those characters who embrace those things, and there are those who resist. And that's what makes for good drama. And so you're rooting for some of these characters, and some of the other ones you know, feel sad for because they just don't get it. And some of them you're mad at because they're doing things wrong, and they ought to
mm-hmm.
be able to see that and get over themselves. So it's a... you know, it's a rich way of storytelling.
Mm. Now, I want to move up to your next novel because that comes out around Mother's Day next year, right?
Yes. Well, I'm very excited about it. It's been delayed. Both my dear parents passed away in the last 2 years, and
oh, sorry.
I was fortunate to be able to really spend most of that time with them. I just had to explain this to my publisher, and the publisher was very patient and understanding about it. So that's why the third novel didn't come out on time. But now I will just encourage our listeners by saying I do have 350-page manuscript sitting on my desk, so it's
right
along.
On. Why Hearts
yeah.
Keep Secrets? Hey, that goes with it, okay? Why Hearts Keep Secrets? That's going to be coming out around Mother's Day. Good timing for that, you know. So that's
yeah.
going to be the next saga, the next mystery, you know. We like that. And, you know, that's what you're known for, is this cliffhanger. So it's good, you know, extend that cliffhanger, make everybody want it more. But if you've got a novella coming in the middle, so that's good.
Yeah, this is book 3 out of 5. And so we're sort of like, we've been going uphill, and we're going to be on, you know, on the top of it for this book. And at the same time, I will say this book goes deeper than any of the others, because it's delving into everybody's secrets. And so it's really an interesting one to write. And, you know, when you start looking into secrets in your writing, it's funny, but there have been some interesting secrets that have come up. I took a trip this past spring and summer with my husband, and we were traveling to see some of the older relatives before they pass away.
Mm-hmm.
And get their stories and have them identify pictures and things like that. And it's been very rich and lovely. And what do you know? We came up with some interesting family secrets, and I thought, oh, this is perfect. it'll all show up in my novel one way or the other.
Oh, my gosh, we need to send you ours.
Yeah. Well, we all have them, right? I mean, everybody has a good one.
We got some doozies. And it's really odd. We're
and
here
then
in
you
Yuma,
look
Arizona.
At...
We found out some of our family was here, and there's multiple family members all at the same time, all under one man.
All with the
we
same,
didn't know.
All with the same first name.
All at the same time, yeah. So it's interesting.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, so I'm going to the family records. We have a heritage library here, so I want to dig into that before we go off
I'm
on our
scared.
Next trip.
I'm scared. We're going to find more.
I know. But, you know, that's the thing, and I think it's so cool that you said that because, you know, so many times people don't go and get their family history. They'll let drama get in the way or whatever. And, you know, Nancy and I have some crazy family history, and, you know, we weren't in the country to get it. You know, we weren't here, and we should have. And you know, it's unfortunate. And getting that history means so much in moving forward in life sometimes. It lets you know a little bit about your family.
Yeah.
It is so huge. So doing that is so important. It's so important.
It's fun. It's really interesting, too.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes you have to distance yourself from maybe something you don't want to hear, but it's good to know and realize that you didn't do it, somebody else did.
Mara, do you get an having done that and being able to use it in your writing, but for you personally, do you get a better understanding of people from that? Or, like, if you've had questions in your mind or finding, like, a brand new story, sure, does it kind of piece a little bit of history of our country together for you, too?
Oh, it really does. It really does. I sometimes think that this is my PhD in life is I'm earning by writing these books, because I just feel like I'm learning so much, learning about human behavior, motives, why people have done things, what makes somebody apparently act out of character, but then maybe it really isn't out of character if you understand them better. Some of the hardships that people have had that you had no idea. You thought that they had it pretty easy, and it turns out, no, they really didn't. All kinds of things like that. Or you'll discover a habit or a particular like that you have in yourself, and then you find out that your great-great-grandmother was also somebody who enjoyed that same thing.
Hmm. I know that's it's trippy.
I always feel like there's a generation, I probably shouldn't say which one, because I'll make a lot of people mad, that just had a problem with the truth and telling their children the truth. And it just seems to be, you know, the more people I talk to that have that same feeling, there's a generation that, I don't know what it was, if there was some cultural thing that you don't talk about this or that, but there was a lot of hiding of the truth, a lot.
Yeah, you're right. And there were certain things that were not talked about. You know, we met with a relative who said, well, I don't want anyone to know that I was married for the first time. I don't want them. I only want them to know about the second marriage.
You could be related to us.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. You know, you're right. There, and in our day and age now, we're really much more interested in authenticity and really telling the truth And that's very much what my next novel is all about.
That's interesting that you say that, because I think, you know, we've had these shifts through the years. You know, like, okay, now we're going to stand up on this. We're going to stand up all these different issues people stand up and you know, stand up for, which we should. But there's also, like, levels of understanding that have to happen. You know, you've got to go back in the past and actually work through it, and even for your own family history, because you have to somehow understand. I mean, if you think about people that went through the Vietnam War and things like that, you can't just dismiss something and, like, because you don't understand it yet. You've got to really do as much as you can to put your feet in their shoes. What was it like for the kids at home, and what was it like for the mother at home? What was it like for him out there or her out there? You know, and there's this understanding, and education comes at different levels, different times for every person. So, you know, sometimes we get mad at people and not understand, and that's something that happens in families. We don't understand. We get mad at it. We get frustrated.
Mm-hmm.
But it's because we're at different levels of understanding, I think, or that education part. So I think what you're doing going in the past, you're able to assimilate this and then put it into a good story, you know what I mean, for people to learn from. But it is true.
Yeah.
I think the arts help people understand life better. And it's it gives you, it's a spoonful of sugar makes the medicine go down. That's what it is, you know?
Yes, I agree. Yeah, it's a way of, you know, you can be safe because you're just reading a story. And yet, what that story is really telling you can be very profound and cause you to think differently about your own situation.
Absolutely.
And I just think that is so kind of the universe to give us a way of processing the tough stuff while being protected.
Right.
Well, you know, they say the pen's mightier than the sword.
Heck yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And that's true.
A smile can stop an army.
Yeah.
Okay, so on that level, all right, it's time for the happy hour game. Woo! So, Mara, if you could spend happy hour with anyone alive or passed on, who would it be? Where would you spend it? What would you drink? And what would you talk about?
Well, I love this game of yours. Absolutely love it. Loved playing it the last time. So this time, I want to go to Sardi's in New York, which is the theater restaurant. And
yeah.
I want to sit there with my dad and with Jim Buckley. Now, Jim Buckley founded the Pewter Plough Playhouse in Cambria, and he died at the age of 102, just 2 weeks before we opened.
My dad
directed C-Marks in Colorado 30 years ago, and he died just 2 weeks before we opened in Colorado, and he died at the age of 100. So I would like to think that these two amazing gents, and they had become friends, I would like to think that they are, you know, toasting us and talking about the play with me and with Gardner, the playwright. So that's me sitting with three fantastic guys who have passed on but who will never be forgotten.
Now, what are you going to drink?
Well, I'm probably going to drink Irish coffee in honor of the Irish play, C-Marks.
I like that. Yeah, that's good. Now I want to come
hang
out there. Can I come be a fly on the wall? I can like zap myself into being a fly.
You can come be the honored guest at the table. You don't have to be no fly on the wall.
Okay, thank you. I want to come in and hear that because I think, you know, that there's the theater, I don't want that to go away from our lives. You know, I sometimes feel like
any
really passionate about that live entertainment.
Yes.
Has to be, we have
live
to keep pushing
theater.
It.
Oh, my gosh, the moments that happen, you know, in this play we have some moments that are where we're very vulnerable, and they're tender and funny, and you'll hear the audience gasp, or you'll hear them laugh, or that you'll hear them mutter something to themselves, and they're recognizing something in that moment, and then their energy comes back to us up on the stage and goes right back into our performance, and so it's like an energy exchange. And every time we do the show, it gets a little better. I think because of that, we get something from the audience and they get something from us. People stay afterwards and talk to us for like an hour, asking questions about the play and about
That's
ourselves
awesome.
And so forth. It's just this beautiful experience.
This is awesome. Mara, so good to have you back on the show.
Mm-hmm.
And I love your name,
Thank
Mara,
you.
Because it reminds me of Masai Mara, where I grew up, kind of part of me
oh,
as a kid.
Oh, wow.
You know, it just when I hear the word Mara, I'm like, oh, that takes mm-hmm. me to, like, that's like homecoming. That's the land of, you know, the world to me.
Beautiful.
But everyone,
I love that.
Go to MaraPearl.com. It's P-U-R-L, Mara, M-A-R-A, is MaraPearl.com, and keep up with her there and Facebook and Twitter, and watch for her new novella coming out in time for Valentine's Day, because we all love otters. So it's When Otters Play,
mm-hmm.
and then Why Hearts Keep Secrets. That's out for Mother's Day. So you know there's some scandal going on there. Now you know
yeah.
she's got some dirt on her family, too. And I mean, I didn't mean it that way. Thanks so much for joining us, Mara. Always a pleasure.
Thank you.
Enjoy yourself in Cambria, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I will. Thank you both. Happy travels to you both. You're just wonderful. Thanks again.
You are,
Thank
too.
You.
Take care.